We're talking about discovering hope this year, discovering hope this Christmas. Last week, we talked a little bit more about discovering hope ourselves, if you remember, each one of us making that right choice to say, God alone is enough for me, I need no other thing, making the right choice ourselves in light of what we see He's done for us, how far He's come for us, but a little bit more of a focus on ourselves. This week, we're going to look more at how do we help others have hope? How do we help others who need it? How do we help them discover hope? And as I say, that's what we call empathy. So what I hope we'll see today is, one, when empathy is needed. Just briefly, a few words about the kinds of situations in which empathy is needed. Then two, we're going to look at how empathy is shown and how it's not shown, but how we show empathy to those around us who are hurting. And then three, what empathy really has to do with Christmas. When it's needed, how it's shown, what it has to do with Christmas. And through this, one of the things that I hope will come out most clearly, one of the things that I think will be most helpful for us, is to say this. When you see somebody who's in a place of need and you care about how they are doing, the best thing you can do, if you care about them, the best thing you can do is tell them, I care about you. If you see somebody is struggling, you care about how they're doing, the best thing you do is tell them, not ask them some kind of question that you think will indicate that you care. Don't try to do something to indicate that you care. Just say, I care about you. All right. But I'm getting ahead of myself. First, when empathy is needed. There is a swirl of passages where this theme comes up with Christmas. It's not just one or two. The whole idea of Christmas, as I said last night, Isaiah 9:2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, on them a light has dawned. It's one of the great Christmas passages in the Old Testament. It's quoted early on in the book of Matthew. Christmas is not happiness in spite of, instead of the darkness. Christmas is all about the darkness, not reveling in it, but a response to it. Provision for meeting others in it is all about the darkness where the light shines. The people walking in darkness. Empathy is needed essentially when life is hard. Right? Empathy is needed when things are rough. I often visualize it as being down in a pit. It's dark. It's scary. It's depressing. You feel like you're struggling. Maybe you feel like you're overwhelmed. You're in over your head. Maybe you visualize it more like a desert. It's dry. It's barren. Maybe you feel all alone. You want to talk about discovering hope? Hope is needed when things aren't going great. Remember what the Apostle Paul says? Hope that is seen is no hope at all. Romans chapter 8. Something about the very nature of hope requires us to be in a situation where that which we hope for, we're not experiencing. You don't have it, and that's why you're hoping for it. You're still longing for it here and now. Empathy is needed in situations. Here's what happens. Where empathy is needed is when one person is down in the pit and somebody else is up here. They happen not to be in the pit in that moment. They see them down there and something in us kicks in and instinctively we say, it stinks that you're down there. And I wish you weren't down there. And I want to do something to help you get up out of there. I want to do something to lift you up. If you're stuck, to get you on a better footing, to turn you around, to set you in a better direction. That's where empathy is needed. And what's interesting is so many of the Christmas passages start off with that kind of language. Start off with that kind of, people are stuck and they're going to get turned around. They're going to have their hearts placed in a better place. They're going to get turned. Luke 1:16 and 17. The angel comes and announces John the Baptist's birth. All right, not Jesus, John the Baptist. The angel comes, Gabriel, he says to Zechariah the father, says that John, he will turn the hearts. in a bad place, going to get turned, going to get lifted out of it. He will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. The people are in a situation they shouldn't be in. God's going to send someone to get them out of it, to get their hearts in the right place again, to lift them up, to prepare them. That mention of Elijah, if the rest of the wording doesn't cue us into this, the mention of Elijah is a reference to the very close of the Old Testament. The end of the Old Testament, the prophet Malachi leaves off with, "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and will turn the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse." And then there is this period of prophetic silence. 400 years of hearing nothing, of darkness, not getting any sort of word or comfort or hope. And finally, at the end of that 400 years, Gabriel comes and says, "Now. Now is the time. Now is the time when we're going to lift people out of this. We're going to turn their hearts around again." Luke 1:16-17. And as I say, it's not just there. It's all over the place with Christmas. When Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mother, when she becomes pregnant, one of the things she says, Luke 1:25, is, she says, "Thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among the people." He's taken away my reproach. I was in a pit, I was in shame, and he's lifted me up out of it. That's what we all want. That's what we all need. That's what we want to give other people when they're hurting. That's what we want other people to do for us when we're hurting. That's what empathy is all about. That's where empathy is needed. Right? Those kinds of situations in our own lives and the beginning of the Christmas accounts. That's where it's needed. So, two, if that's where it's needed, what is it really? And how is it shown? How do you show empathy? If someone is in a dark time and you see them, you want to help them out of it, you care how they are doing, the best thing you can do is tell them, "I care how you're doing." Not to ask them, "How are you doing?" If someone's in a dark place and you care how they're doing, tell them, don't ask them to try to indicate that you care. And of course, I'm speaking from personal experience. I have wrestled with whether or not to do this. And I have wrestled with whether or not to do it now, whether it's too fresh. My point in saying this today is not, hear me loud and clear, my point in saying this is not to make any of the 300 of you who have asked us how we're doing feel bad, all right? Because the other 300 just didn't get a chance yet, but they would. This is instinctive, right? This is just natural for us. You have inherited from your culture, as have I, this incredibly bad habit of greeting people with asking them how they're doing. Normally, it's just worthless and pointless. When somebody is hurting, it's the exact opposite of what they need. I'll hope to show you that. One of the lines when our first child died that really helped us was, if people say something, it hurts. And if people don't say anything, it hurts. And the reality is, because it's not whether people say anything or not, the reality is just life hurts right now. So it doesn't matter what people say or not. You all have been terrific. Each time, you've gone above and beyond the call with meals, with gifts. Casey and Terry stepping in to preach, the understanding of the staff. Our church family has been terrific to us. You're great at caring. I just want to give us one more piece that I think can make us even better at caring. And that's to stop asking how people are doing. But as I say, it's instinctive. And that's actually part of why I want to address it. It's very, very natural. It's almost a gut reflex to ask how somebody is doing when you know they're hurting and you bump into them for the first time. And as I say, my point is not to try to make anyone feel guilty, but we have had numerous people come up to us and say, "You're in the middle of this, and even your job is to try to help people. to care for people who are going through dark times. Now you're in the middle of it yourselves once more. So could you tell us, what is it, what's really helpful to hear? We have numerous people ask us, what do you actually want to hear from us? What can we say? And they've asked us, what should we not say? We've had enough people ask us that. I thought, let's go for it. Let's share. Let's get better at caring for people who are in hard times. But people ask, because you're in the middle of this and because you think about professionally how to care for people, what are you learning are the best things to do and not to do? So the thing about asking somebody how you are doing, and it doesn't matter if it's the upbeat, hey, how's it going? Did they forget? Don't they care? It doesn't matter if it's the upbeat version or if it's the really thoughtful, how are you? Really? With the head bob. You got to get the head bob in there, right? The thing about it is, if someone is in darkness and you ask how they are doing, the thing they really need is to have their eyes lifted out of the darkness, placed beyond the circumstances surrounding them, to have their eyes lifted out and asking, how are you down there? How are you? Does the exact opposite. It takes their eyes and places them right back down on our situation. I'm telling you, it's the exact opposite of what's helpful. You can think about it with that story of Peter walking on the water and all those metaphorical lessons we normally draw from it. Although I believe it's not intended primarily as a metaphor for our spiritual life, but as evidence. We don't get to walk on the water. He did, because the one who made water was standing right in front of him. It's evidence that he was here. But we normally draw metaphors for our spiritual life from them. How does it always go? You remember? Peter is in a storm. As long as his eyes stay on Jesus, he's overcoming. He's staying above it. It's when his eyes go down to the water, the wind, the waves, that he begins to sink. How are you doing? That's what how are you doing does. It takes our eyes right back down on our situation. I am happy to admit this is just me. This is in the first place, this is me. And not everyone is like this. We're individual people with individual circumstances. If somebody is on the fringe of our church family, or if they have slipped through the cracks, maybe especially if they're in a situation that it's gone on for years and they feel like maybe everybody else has forgotten and they have moved on, but they're still stuck in it, it may be for that one the most life-giving thing that could ever happen to them is somebody come along and say, I haven't forgotten about you. How are you? I'm happy to admit that. But even there, I think it begins with a perception of their situation, not just barging in with this assumption of I'm going to check in with them. It begins with a perception regarding when it's helpful, when it is appropriate to ask the question is, I think it's more appropriate to ask it when you've been down in their pit with them for a while. Then, hey, we've been here. We've plunged the depths. We've kind of come up for air, but we're back down, just kind of gauging where we're at right now. When you've been in their pit with them for a while. But I think what happens is so many of us use these questions as a way of trying to climb down in the pit with them. We confuse willingness to be in the pit with being in the pit. We confuse what you do when you're down there with how you get down there. Picture it this way. Imagine a mom or a wife, a mom and a wife, whose husband has left her this year. She has a friend that she's processed this with and walked this journey with, and they finally get to the point where they say, you know what, we just need to get you some space, we need you to get away from all this. Let's just go out, let's just relax, let's have a social outing, and the two of them go out to see a movie. You happen to bump into them in line at the movie theater to get the tickets. You know she's hurting, you know she's been through a tough time, so you want to care, you go up to her, and you want to show that you care, you go up to her and you say, how are you? What's going on in her mind? She's got mixed emotions towards her ex. She's angry towards him. She's confused. Depending on the situation, she might have some hope, some sense of relief. She's got mixed emotions. She's going to process that in line at a movie theater. She's got mixed emotions towards her husband, ex-husband. She's got mixed emotions towards God. I still trust you, but why'd you allow this to happen? I want to hope in you, but I'm struggling because of everything that just took place in Miss Vallis. She's got mixed emotions towards him. She's got mixed emotions towards God. She's got kids. Maybe she's got 4 kids, 2 boys, 2 girls. She's consumed with how they are doing, processing it both as a batch and individually because each one of them are handling it differently. She's got financial issues. She's excited about this new job, but still, how is she going to handle all of this by herself? She's concerned about their house, but grateful for this provision, but still, how's it actually going to work out? And in the midst of all of that, she kind of feels guilty for having this social outing, but she thinks this is the best thing just to clear her mind, finally, to get some space to breathe, to get away from it for just a moment, to just relax. How are you? Right back in the middle of it. You're going to walk away, and I don't mean to be too pointed with this and assume your motives. We're going to walk away from asking that, saying, I'm glad I got to check in with her. She can hardly remember why she's there. We mean well. I know we mean well. We've inherited this from the culture. We mean it as a way of sharing the burden, right? How are you? I want to get under the burden with you. But how are you doing? Is asking them to describe the burden. I picture it like you're carrying this heavy load and you got to get there. And so I'm just trying to get there. And somebody comes along. How you doing is asking them to stop and describe the weight they're carrying. It's nice to see you is carrying the burden with them. Because you're not asking them to stop. You're not putting the onus on them to respond. You're just meeting them where they are, asking nothing from them. It's nice to see you. That's what's helpful to hear. That's what's helpful to hear. It's good to see you. I'm so glad you're here. If you care how someone is doing, tell them. When you do empathy well, you're going to feel like you didn't do anything. Because what they need is not for you to do something. They just need you to be with them. And the reason why it's effective, even though you feel like you don't do anything, is think about it this way. If you are a believer in Jesus Christ, you have the Holy Spirit inside of you. That means simply getting down beside the person, putting your arm around them, and not saying a thing that's trying to be profound, and not asking them to do anything to move towards you. Just doing that is bringing the Holy Spirit into their pit. And that relational connection is turning the light on for them. Now, I've been advocating for the best thing I think we can do sometimes is just simply to say, it's nice to see you. The thing about asking the question is you're putting the onus on them to respond, and it's overwhelming if you're in the pit. To try to verbalize what you are going through enough in order to be able to articulate it. And the thing about pits is they generally don't allow for too many people down there. You cannot possibly process something that's really weighty with more than a handful of people. Anytime that I'm asked, I'm really going to process, how are you guys? It takes at least an hour to get into it with any kind of substance. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting for the one speaking, and it's exhausting for the one listening. I cannot possibly do it 6 times in a hallway. And neither can anybody else. Right? If the social setting doesn't allow for an hour to process it, don't ask it. Tell them you're glad to see them. I'm sure that those words, as I was just getting into before we tried again, could also be perceived as, I'm up here and you're down there. It's nice to see you. It could be perceived that way. And this is where I don't know that anything is truly scalable to 600. I've tried to imagine, would it really work if 600 different people came up and said, hey, it's nice to see you again. I could probably see myself grumpily snapping internally, well, it's not nice that I had to be gone, right? So I don't know that anything is scalable to 600. It's not what people do or don't do. It's just the reality that life hurts right now. But in our experience, what helps In our experience, those who have said things like that have seemed to recognize no words are enough. There's been a slower pace and more perception, and they haven't put us on the spot. And we've walked away with a sigh of relief. Job's friends, you know, the best thing they did was sit in silence with him for 7 days. It's when they started trying to fix things that everything went bad. Empathy is placing no expectation on the other person to be the one to move towards you, at least not first. And empathy is getting down in that pit with them. And you don't do it by asking, you do it just by getting in and arm around. Now, where does that come from? Is that just a little bit of psychologizing? It's easier to write than to say. No, you've got to just go back for it. Where does this come from? Is this just sociology? Is this just some sociological principles? Or is this just my personal preference for coping with grief? If that's all it is, I should not be up here speaking. Or is there something more to this? Is there something deeper underlying this kind of understanding of empathy, making this more than just somebody's individual preferences and something that's truer than just the latest psychology textbook? Where does this come from, getting down in somebody else's pit with them? Someone who sees somebody else in need and not expecting them to climb out themselves, but climbing down into the pit, into their circumstances with him. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. This theme of lifting others out of despair, restoring them, returning them by getting down with them is all throughout the Christmas accounts. Is there with John the Baptist? Is there with Jesus? And you see, what I think happens is, I think it's easy to read about John the Baptist coming, being born, and to jump straight to his preaching ministry. Because that's what the Gospels do. He's born, preaching ministry. At least mostly that's what the Gospels do. But we jump to his preaching in which he really lets people have it. I'm supposed to turn the hearts of the people? Look what he does. Woe to you, Pharisees. You better shape up. You better repent. You better turn. It's easy to look at that and justify getting preachy ourselves. You're down there. Here's what you need to do, and I will tell you how to do it. But prior to exhorting others, to challenging others, both John and Jesus, what happens? For both of them, we are given these lines. For John the Baptist, it's the end of Luke chapter 1. The very last verse of Luke 1, or at the end of Luke 1, Zechariah, John's father, is prophesying. And he's prophesying about being lifted out of bondage, about a light shining on those in darkness, about feet being guided. And you get to Luke 1, verse 80, the very last verse, and we are told, the child grew, John the Baptist, grew and became strong and lived in the desert. Now what's that? That means John the Baptist did not come and say, I'm supposed to turn you, now hear ye, get with the program. It means John the Baptist came and entered the darkness. He went into the desert. He lived in the desert. He came alongside and identified with the condition of the people he was sent to. He didn't stay separate from them. Among other things, like prophetic credentials, among other things, he goes into the desert. He is entering the human condition first for decades. And it's not just John. God had an eternal rescue mission to lift his people out of the pit. And when the time came to fully embark on it, he didn't come and say, all right, let's get moving, chop, chop. He came and was born in the cold, in the dark. He was born in the dark, in poverty and need, and lived that way for 3 decades first. He's coming alongside us. He's entering our condition before doing anything about what we were in need of. His very becoming was the doing something about that we needed. Luke 2:52, the end of Luke 1 is John the Baptist, the end of Luke 2 is Jesus. Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. That's not just idle reporting on Luke's part. He's not just marking time. That is Luke saying he became one of us. He came alongside us. He became a baby and had to grow. He entered our condition. He stepped down into our pit. We got to speak words of truth and comfort and exhortation to one another, absolutely. But they've got to be preceded by a ministry of presence that goes far beyond what most of us are used to typically giving. Being with somebody first. And we're not used to doing it because it's just not as efficient that way. And we love our American efficiency. But the incarnation is the ultimate display of empathetic climbing down into somebody else's darkness. He was born into a displaced home. He had a stepdad, a family on the run, the rough and tough daily grind of blue-collar work. Look at him coming down into your pit, into your darkness. The incarnation is the ultimate display of empathy, and yet there is even more. His connecting with us, his taking our situation and putting it on himself doesn't stop at the incarnation. At the cross, Jesus Christ did the ultimate putting himself in someone else's shoes. He put himself in our place. He took what you and I deserve, went into our darkness, went into our tomb. He went into the tomb itself, the ultimate pit, and turned on the light. There. There's no pit he can't join you in. Look what he did. There's no pit he can't see you through. That's what Norman Kennedy told me in the hospital 2 weeks ago. He told me a couple of other things. I'll save those for another time. Most of the visit, and Mildred and Norma can tell you, most of the visit he was kind of murky. Towards the end, we had this stretch of a few minutes where he was clear as day. And he said, speaking of his own life, looking back on something that happened to him 60 years ago, there's no pit he can't see you through. Because look, he gets down into the pit with us. Him coming down is the only thing that will get you out. And him coming down, when you see that, when we see that and experience that, it will change how we go about helping others who are in pits themselves. Not asking them to move to us, just going down beside them. I think that's how we help others discover hope. That's Christmas.